You don't need a system outage to know when your PPE isn't delivering what it should. Maybe pricing takes an extra step to verify, maybe updates are taking longer than expected, maybe your team has built workarounds just to keep loans moving. What starts as a few small delays can gradually become the way the work gets done. The reality is, a modern PPE should do more than provide pricing. It should deliver real-time accuracy, seamless workflow execution, intelligent automation, and the confidence to act without hesitation. It should help your team move faster, operate more efficiently, and focus on performance, not process. So ask yourself, is your PPE helping your organization perform at its full potential, or is it forcing your team to work around its limitations? Take a closer look at what you should expect from a modern pricing engine. Visit optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Again, that's optimalblue.com/optimalblueppe. Stop accepting friction as part of the process. Make sure your PPE is helping your team move faster, execute smarter, and capture every opportunity.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome, everybody. We have a great show for you today in the interest of making sure you know what to watch out for as an originator, a capital markets person, or just someone interested in the mortgage industry and some great commentary. Stay tuned. We've got some good subjects coming up. We will kick it off, as always, with a timely market update. And then I get to talk to Mike Vogue, our head of corporate strategy, who was representing us at MBA's Chairman's Conference last week in the great state of Maine. So we'll talk about some highlights there and some things he learned and some things I think will be very interesting to all of you. First, though, in the way of just high-level data, our OBMMI, conventional 30-year, still hovering around that 6.5 mark. You know, as long as this uncertainty around the war and the Strait of Hormuz exists, we'll probably be about in that range. 10-year, again, about 2 points lower. 10-year Treasury is about 4.5%. Hasn't quite breached that previous record yet, but still hovering around that 4.5 mark. Let's talk to James and Alex now and see what's going on in the market.
Good morning, Alex. This morning, it's just myself, James Kale, and Alex Ebner. Jim is out of the office, so we'll be tackling the econ updates. Luckily, it was a quiet weekend. No, you know, world-changing events, unless I blinked and missed something. Anything, Alex?
Thanks, James. There was some developments over the weekend. We're seeing the long-awaited movement on the Iran-U.S. conflict, ceasefire peace deal. It's being touted as a peace deal right now, but what we're looking at that will be signed later this week, as long as things go to plan, is an additional 60-day ceasefire with the real big bullet points on it being that the Strait of Hormuz will be reopened to shipping traffic under Iranian and Omani supervision, which is different than what it was before the war, but it does mean that ships will be in transit again, which is what the market's really been waiting for. The market seems to be pricing this particular peace deal extension of the ceasefire pretty well. Equities have rallied pretty strongly today. And in addition to that, the bond market seen rates fall a little bit of a bull steepener this morning. But yeah, we should see ships moving again. But again, at the same time, it's only another 60-day ceasefire, and they need to continue to negotiate a full peace deal. And on top of that, in my opinion, you know, the ostensible reason for the beginning of this conflict, Iran's nuclear program, and you know how much they are enriching uranium, that has not yet been resolved as an issue on the table. So there's definitely still some stumbling blocks out there in regards to this conflict. You know, the wild card of the proxy conflict that's occurring at the same time between Israel and Lebanon and Iranian-backed groups that operate inside of Lebanon, particularly Hezbollah. So you know, it seems that there's maybe, you know, peace on the horizon, but I could see us backtracking at the same time. So it's really anyone's guess at this point. But right now, it's expected that we will have wet ink on perhaps digital paper by Friday.
Agreed. So I saw, you know, around Friday that we were expecting a deal signed Sunday. Sunday, I saw the Truth Social tweet saying, let the oil flow. As of this morning, it seems the actual deal will be signed on Friday, assuming all things hold. But the deal will get oil flowing again. Now, as we've been saying, it's going to take a while to get everything, spigots all turned back on, all the infrastructure that has been hit rebuilt. So this is not, even if this 60-day ceasefire, we immediately roll into another 60-day and then 120-day and then we resolve everything, we should not expect gas prices to plummet. I have seen talk that, yeah, the futures are predicting prices coming down, but they might actually be a little presumptuous or a little early, just being that the biggest stumbling blocks, the causes for the war, have not yet been resolved and agreed to. But hopefully that's a smooth path over the next 60 days.
Hopefully so. Hopefully so. I'm with you. It should be, it won't be a fall off the cliff in regards to energy prices. It'll be a slow and steady decline, which if you look at futures contracts on oil, that is reflected pretty well, just kind of tailing off to the right. So I'm with you there. This conflict and its effects will take quite a bit of time to resolve, but hopefully we can, in the meantime, begin to see some relief on the inflation front, which has been, I think, the number one domestic pressure that this conflict has created. We got the May CPI, PPI numbers last week, and they came in quite warm, maybe hot, depending on your reading of them. What were your thoughts there, James?
Yeah, last week, of course, was the story of inflation. So the expectation was that we're going to land around 4.2% year over year for CPI, which is where we were. Now, if you strip food and energy out of this, we're down to 2.9%. So 2.9% is not where everyone wants it to be, but it's not as brutal if these gas prices come back down. The number, that 2.9, if you do drill into it on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, you can see that shelter, transport, and medical care all rose above 3.5%. So what that tells me is the inflation in that 2.9% is not just oil and gas, right? It is actually, things have bled through. It has become more expensive on the actual goods. The services are starting to raise their prices. So that's going to be a little bit stickier. That will take more time even as we progress. On the other side of this, a little late in the week, PPI, so the producer side, that was expected and did come in at about 6.5% core. So stripping out oil and food is 5.1%. These numbers are much higher. This is not where anyone wants to see them. Credit to the producers for so far eating this, taking it on the chin, seeing that number is much higher than what we're seeing in CPI, but it's nowhere near where we want to be. Again, if you look on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, you can drill into these numbers a little bit. I suppose I would say on the upside, in a way, this number is very driven by industrial chemicals. Industrial chemicals, of course, have a base of oil, petrol, gas. So even stripping out technically food and oil for energy, oil has bled through in PPI, specifically in chemicals. So as those tankers get flowing again, that should begin to move. It's going to take time, but where the heart of the inflation for producers is, that is entirely around oil. That might be more ratchetable in the medium term here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I'm with you there. And I do agree. We've begun to see 3 months in here, the bleed in effect into across the board, different products across the numbers that are tracked for these inflation metrics. We were saying from the get-go that, hydrocarbons are essential to modern life, and that it wouldn't just be limited to fuel prices, that it would eventually be seen in just about every sector. Turning towards this week, we are looking at, I think the number one thing that everyone's looking forward to keeping their eye on is Wednesday. It's the FOMC decision. We are not expecting any change to that federal funds rate this time around. In fact, on the back of the peace deal we were just talking about, it's expected that the rate hike that was expected for late in the year, perhaps December, actually has been kicked out a little bit on this Monday morning. Right now, Bloomberg showing somewhere in March of 2027. CME Group, their number doesn't go to a majority expectation for a hike until January. So sometime in Q1 of 2027 is when the market is currently pricing that next rate hike. But that's really not why everyone's keeping their eye on the FOMC meeting this week. This is Kevin Warsh, the new Federal Reserve Chairman's first meeting, and everyone is very interested to see how he will be deferring in the way he acts in regards to his successor, Powell, how he answers those questions during the press conference. And what I'm especially interested in seeing is his new toolkit. There was a lot of questions during his congressional testimonies on what he would do to make over the Fed. He has really said they need to kind of stop looking at so many backwards data points. He definitely wants to make the Fed nimbler, more lean. And the one thing that I'm keeping my eye on is if he's going to use what I kind of see as his ruler for inflation, which is it's called trimmed mean PCE. This is a number that's put out by the Dallas Fed. And essentially, you know, give or take a few percent, it whacks the top third and the bottom third of those inflationary items from every report. And so you end up with just the middle third of items and how much they've changed. To give you kind of some context to where trim mean PCE lands in comparison to your base PCE and your core PCE right now is the PCE number last time around came around 3.6, 3.8%, I believe. And right now the trimmed PCE number for the last release in May came out at 2.3%. So over a full percentage point difference by that ruler, we'd be showing that we're trending near that 2% target inflation. I'm yet to be convinced on this one, and I do want to see if Warsh is even going to pull it out of the toolbox and reference it. So that all stands to still be seen.
So I suppose the argument on this trimmed mean is, hey, there's these outliers around the far edges that we really shouldn't consider. Random days that are a little too high, number comes in a little too hot, so strip those out. And in doing so, it reduces the mean quite significantly and puts us at, you know, much closer to the target.
Correct. The idea behind it is that it strips out any sort of geopolitical tensions. If it's filtering out the oil shock entirely so far. As you were just covering, we're beginning to see the costs of raw fuel and raw hydrocarbons bleed into industrial products and the sort. But that hasn't yet been reflected in that trimmed mean PCE number, the latest of which came out at the end of May. We might see that pop a little bit in June in line with what we saw from CPI and PPI in June. But that still remains to be seen. And yeah, just if you want to get into the real nitty gritty of it, trimmed mean PCE on average takes off the top 31% of items and the bottom 24%. So it's actually understating a little bit. It is biased a little bit to the underside as it's removing less of the downside items from the number. So again, it just remains to be seen if Warsh is going to really pull this one out of his toolkit, but that's what I'm looking for from this meeting.
Definitely. That it would be an interesting change to how the regime works there. If that gets pulled out, that's the new measure. And I'd be interested in how he'll sell the rest of the governing body there on it, but something to look forward to.
Absolutely. It remains really to be seen how hawkish or dovish he'll be. He's been extremely dovish throughout his life. So we'll have to see how he's currently viewing today's situation.
Well, that might be the end of our major topics. A lot to look forward to. Hopefully, you know, come Friday, we'll have settlements. Oil will start flowing. We'll get, you know, the wheels greased, moving a little bit healthier again. I'm sure we're all looking forward to peace. Any other major items from your end, Alex?
And not outside the normal course of events, we will get initial jobless claims, which have trended up just a little bit recently. Just about to scrape 230, I believe, last week. And the expectation this week is 229. So keep an eye out there. If we're seeing reemergent labor market concerns. But aside from that, this should be a pretty quiet week outside of that Federal Reserve meeting.
And a short week at that as well. Anyone following the SIFMA calendar, we will have Friday, Juneteenth off this Friday. So it'll be nice to get a 3-day weekend. And then, you know, coming into it, 2 weeks away, America's 250th anniversary, 4th of July coming up.
Looking forward to it.
Well, thank you very much for the time, Alex, and I'll talk to you next week.
As always, appreciate it, James. We'll talk soon.
Okay, as promised, our own head of corporate strategy was at MBA's Chairman's Conference this last week in Maine. This conference is one of those that seems to fly under the radar a little bit. I honestly did not know this very specific conference existed, but it's definitely been out there for many years. Ton of influential people there from our industry sharing ideas. And I'd love to get a little peek into that with Mike. So welcome, Mike. Thanks for being on the pod again.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Yeah, it was a great event. It was the first time I've attended this one. It's a little bit of a smaller audience, and it's focused for a C-suite and senior executives at both mortgage lenders, tech providers, and folks who are working within the MBA. It's not one of those conferences where you have 20 or 30 meetings over a 2 or 3 day period. It's a little bit more kind of like focused on naturally networking, which is a little bit of a change for some of these conferences that we go to where you're speed dating the whole time. But with that like senior level of people in place and some of those guidelines, it's a little bit more relaxed, but we're talking about a lot of the trends and policies that could be impacting the mortgage world these days.
That's great. Yeah, I went to one in Beaver Creek, Colorado, right up the road from us here. It was the Midwinter Conference, and I think it was pretty similar. It was tended to be exec types. There wasn't like an exhibit hall. It wasn't sessions all day long. It was a lot of networking, but also a lot of really good, like the sessions that they did have were pretty amazing and very, I don't know, you felt a little bit like you were getting a little inside baseball because it was a more intimate group of people and it was a little bit interactive. I thought that was cool. And the obviously Beaver Creek's a beautiful spot. You were in Maine, right? Which that looked, I saw some of the pictures online. That looked pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was a fantastic venue. It was a beautiful time of Europe there in Maine right now. So it was in Portsmouth, Maine, which is about an hour south of Portland. So I even rented a car. I haven't rented a car in years. So flew into Portland and then rented a car and drove down and definitely had some great speakers. A couple of the sessions where the senior folks of the agency spoke, and when Bob Brokesmith gave his kind of like policy state of the union, they asked us to keep a lot of it inside those four walls. I'll try and share what I can. But it was one of those things where folks are getting quite candid about opinions on the industry, but you can't really break that trust or you lose that candidness, right? So there's a little bit of give and take there, but it was really helpful to be in there as we kind of think about our strategy here at Optimal Blue going forward. So it's really awesome to have those insights.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that inside baseball, right? So I believe Zach Cass was there and he gave a presentation. So he was formerly with OpenAI. That's a pretty cool get, I think, for the MBA and for that conference. Like, what'd you think of that presentation?
It was quite memorable. I read a lot of books, and before we went in there, they were passing out free copies of his book, and I kind of just pushed it to the side. I was like, I've got enough things I'm reading right now. I don't need another thing to add to the list of books I don't finish. And after the presentation, I ran for his book. It was one of those where, you know, he asked everybody to turn their phone down, like over, and get really invested in the presentation. And he formerly was the head of go-to-market at OpenAI. And, you know, I think he kind of deems himself like an AI futurist. And the big things that he wanted to kind of plant in our heads were both to kind of be a little bit of both of an AI doomer and also optimist. And so he was talking about things such as, hey, like, you know, anybody who tells you how busy they are, go look at how much time they spend on their phone. And the idea being is if you're so busy, you wouldn't have 5 to 6 hours of a day spent on your phone, or however many hours you spend a day, right? The importance of the physical world, which I think is an interesting thing for us to think about as people in the mortgage industry, like the desire for housing, even in a world where AI is more ubiquitous and out there, it's probably not going away. And then also like what we know and understand not only about AI today, but also how we think it could be like the idea of screens and social media can be impacting our children and generations coming forward. So Zach recently has had his first child, and that kind of has been like an awakening for him in terms of of the impact of screens and social media and AI as well. And I thought I definitely sympathized a lot with that, with having three young kids of my own. And, you know, we're trying to figure out the right amount of screens. It's impossible to escape, but you also don't want to just let it run rampant, because, you know, sometimes when we get off our trips and take off the tablet away from my kids who normally don't have one, they're like zombies, man. You have to kind of like bring them back to reality. And it takes a couple of days to do that. But generally, it was just a very thought-provoking presentation. I'm really excited to get through his book next on my list. And, you know, I sometimes these presentations that you get from, you know, celebrity type people at these conferences, they can either, you know, say a lot or say a lot but say nothing. And this is one of those where I have a whole page of notes. One of them, which I put on my LinkedIn post, was that the screen is a demon. And like that was an interesting one. I think I'll be saying that in my house when my kids are begging for their tablets. And just in general, you know, we have to consider a world where, hey, we're all stuck to our computers and our screens. Well, what happens if we don't need to do that? Like, where are we going to find value? Where is this next like renaissance going to come from? And that's the title of his book, The Next Renaissance. If we're all like unshackled from computers and screens because of AI, does that allow for a world where we could spend more time on the arts and the humanities and things like that? So it was an interesting way to think about it, especially for somebody who's like poured his life into screens as a professional. What will I do next if I don't need to be in front of a screen?
Yeah, that take has been out there, and it's, I mean, first of all, the screen thing, the screens definitely turn my kids into demons. They wouldn't like me saying this, and one of them is actually here right now, my 10-year-old. If she spends a weekend on the screens because we're busy, we're doing stuff, you take it away Monday, she turns into that, right? And I think we all have a little bit of that addiction in us, and it can get, with kids, they don't know any better, right? It's, they like it, it dopamines their brain. You take it away, it causes a problem. But I also like the conversation, and we could have many podcasts about this, and many podcasts have already kind of contemplated this, and nobody knows ultimately how it will play out. But it is interesting to think that we could go the other way with screens, because the AI is doing the work. We don't need the screens. We don't need to be on the screens, except maybe for some form of entertainment. But then what do we do with our lives? That's the question that scares everybody a lot, I think, is what does life look like what's your purpose if the AI is doing all the work? And we're super productive somehow as a nation, as a country, as a world, a planet. Again, nobody knows the answer, but you said he was kind of optimism, but also doom. Like, what's the doom scenario for him, do you think?
Yeah, I think the doom scenario is mostly us as a population potentially getting dumber with AI. You know, he has a whole slide in his presentation about the movie Idiocracy. I don't know if our listeners have ever seen that, but he is quite concerned about just like a lot of the testing scores that are being tracked out there for the Gen Zs, the Gen Alphas. It does seem that, yeah, at least the way that we tracked intelligence previously, seems the testing scores are going down, reading comprehension's going down. I just saw a tweet this morning where some professor at some college was quoted saying that, hey, I used to assign 100 pages of reading a week. I now only assign 35 pages of reading a week.
Hmm.
And so the fear there is just that AI makes us dumb, which sometimes I find myself even thinking that today when I use Claude or OpenAI or any of these products, where I'm like, instead of like doing this the old fashioned way, I just ask Claude to solve my problems for me or find me the research or find me the information. There's a counterbalance there because I've been in my career for a while now. I'm established, but if you don't like get those bumps and bruises from learning how to do things and like failing and taking one step back and two steps forward and vice versa, like does that stunt your development? I could see that potentially, but that was his main concern.
Yeah, it's a muscle that we used to have to use all the time to be creative or to come up with something simple like an outline for a presentation, and now that kind of just happens and you get to move on to the next thing, which is cool, but it does, you're not flexing that muscle as often as you could be. And yeah, I love the Idiocracy reference. I'm overdue to watch that movie because people have brought this up over the past couple of years, just how it's amazingly predictive, right? It's coming true. And that movie is at least 20 years old, I believe. So,
yeah, there's a scene making the rounds online recently, because I think there's been some talk out there about just like declining birth rates. And there's a really funny scene in there about people who are on one end of the spectrum not having children, and people on the other end of the spectrum having a lot of children. And it's just like a funny, it was portrayed in like a really funny way. And, you know, I think there's a lot of through lines to that movie today, which is like quite interesting.
Spooky, man. All right. Well, it's cool that Zach kind of came in broadly, right? I think it's a little bit even more difficult to try to predict what AI is going to do for our industry or even the finance industry or real estate. So he went kind of broad. He went, what's it going to do to the planet and people and children? What's it doing to children already? That's just an interesting keynote. That's fun that he was there to speak. So sounds like a great conference. And you were in a panel as well. You were on a panel with a couple of folks, and it sounds like there was a pretty good discussion that was had. And you had a couple takeaways that you thought might be interesting for our listeners around, I believe it was the 8 D's of real estate.
So I shared the stage with Garth Graham from Stratmore. We basically took a version of a presentation that Garth did at our summit, that Optimal Blue hosts, and we adjusted it for this conference and updated and co-presented with another person who was moderating the panel. And the idea here that kind of generated the 8 D's of real estate transactions, which I'll get to in a second, is this idea of how to differentiate yourself in this new world of AI and technology. And there's this book by this gentleman named Will Gadara, and it was Unreasonable Hospitality. And this idea of how do you get to that, how do you differentiate in this new world where, well, you have to go to that next level of customer support or customer success. And what we were framing this was the loan officers and folks on the production side who are going to differentiate themselves in the future are the ones who go above and beyond with support and advice and making the transaction feel very special. And in a world where rates are trending up, you know, the folks who just focused on smiling and dialing for refis are probably not going to be successful. So one of the big keys on why we thought the 8 D's was important was going back to this why. Like, why are people doing this? You know, very infrequently, if you try to apply for a mortgage online, you know, they ask for all these documents, they ask for all these questions from you, but they really ask you why. Like, why do you want to do this? And so Garth's been working on this idea of the 8 D's. And so some of these I've even said before, especially when talking about like the difference between prepayment because of rate or prepayment versus life effects, right? And there's always been this idea of like a natural four of like a CPR or a prepayment rate due to these factors. And so the 8 D's, we have diapers, right? So people having new babies and needing new space. We have divorce, which is like the splitting of households. We have downsizing from empty nesters who are retiring. Distance, right? Closer to work or remote work. We've seen a bunch of trends. We have death, right? So you have estate sales or any type of inheritance. Diamonds, right? It kind of goes maybe hand in hand or maybe a precursor to babies, but marriages
sure,
and new
marriage,
couples.
Yeah.
You have debt, so financial stress. And then the last one was doing good, right? So you just you've been doing well professionally and you have the ability to upgrade a home or maybe you get a second home. And so there's these non-rate-based factors that drive people to buy new property. And in the mortgage industry, I feel like we sometimes get down in the dumps because, oh, rates are up and there are 50 basis points. And this like siren song of easy refis is a little bit further away from us. But there's still a lot of like natural flow in the business world from just these transactions that are life events, right? Like there's always new households being formed or dissolving. There's always people being born, people passing away, people doing well, people not doing well, maybe from a debt standpoint. There's a lot out there still. And so it shouldn't just be all storm clouds and rain and shadows because rates are up a little bit higher. The loan officers and production folks who are doing well really understand that why. And so that was kind of like our challenge to the audience was, you know, when you go back, make sure that you understand that why and being able to present different scenarios And this is where I brought in things that we're doing really well at Optimal Blue, using our originator assistant, using our product capture for originators, clearly presenting all the different options that folks have, but then also being able to advise them on the things that they're just missing, right? Our originator assistant helps loan officers, know about those products that might save them a little bit more if they just did X, Y, and Z, maybe from a credit perspective or from a down payment perspective or any loan characteristic. So being able to kind of show this like theoretical thing that folks should think about and then get it down to like a practical, how do I do this in my normal day-to-day by blocking and tackling using technology?
Yeah. I mean, the loans are out there, right? We talk about it a lot on the podcast and just need to get creative around it and potentially use the right tools to find the right borrower, find the right borrower to contact or find the right product for a borrower. And I love the 8Ds. That's creative. Again, we talk about it a lot here. The industry is changing year over year. And we tell people like, stop waiting or worrying about rates. Like that was so 2023. Like it's just not going to happen right now. But you can see it right now with rates being half a point higher than they were at the beginning of the year, mostly because of the war and inflation. Volume's still great. We see volume in a very good spot compared to last year. When you look at any index that we have within OB, which represents half the loans that are getting done out there. So the market's moving. People are buying houses for all of those reasons that you mentioned, or they're refinancing debt because that's one of the D's. So yeah, I love that take on it. It is not, I don't think it's overly optimistic. I think we see it happening. People just need to focus more on what you can control, which is the people that are making a move and how do we help them the best way we can.
Yeah. Mike Frantantoni, the chief economist for the NBA, who I'm sure everyone listening knows, he presented
that guy. Yeah.
A couple of things. One of them was he did use a couple of Optimal Blue's charts in his presentation, one talking about non-QM, which was great to see. And the other chart he showed was just basically volume trends. And yes, we're materially down from 20 and 21, but we're not that far away from 2018, 2017, 2019 levels of volume. So yes, there was this big boom, but we are kind of we're almost in that new normal, I would say. Like it wasn't, we're maybe a half point to a point, maybe higher than where we would want. But, if we stayed at that high five from an optimal OBMMI perspective, I think everybody would be pretty, pretty happy with that.
Yeah. No, the market was screaming. It was moving pretty well early first quarter, late fourth quarter of last year. And obviously, yeah, half a point makes a difference. And we will probably get there at some point. I just don't know if it's going to be in the next couple of years. But yeah, that's a good take. So, I mean, maybe to close it out, what was the highlight? What were some of the highlights for you? Like, what was the one major thing where you were, and maybe it was the AI discussion, maybe it was the 8Ds. Is there something else that you found really interesting that happened or that you witnessed or talked about at the conference?
I'll probably pick on two things that came up in a couple of different venues. We had these like closed door sessions with folks from the NBA and Bob Brooksmith speaking, giving us the insight on policy. We actually also had Sonu from Freddie Mac and Jake from Fannie Mae, both the heads of single family for both those institutions. They're talking, and what were a couple like policy things that kind of stood out. Obviously, a lot of talk about credit. Folks are looking at all the different ways to look at both FICO and Vantage. The other interesting tidbit that I don't think I ever realized, but came out during these conversations, is that both like Fannie and Freddie both have their own internal kind of like credit scoring methodology. Yes, they price off of FICO and or Vantage, but when you run a loan through DU or LP, they come up with their own credit risk metric that is completely different than FICO or Vantage that they use for decisioning internally. That was interesting when that came out because there were folks in the audience who were like, why don't we just use those? Like, why do we have this disconnect then with pricing? So that was super interesting. And obviously credit, just it's at the tip of everyone's tongue right now. The other areas that I thought were interesting that popped up were definitely some talk about Basel III Endgame. I know the NBA has put out a bunch of comments about that as a comment period ends. I think that the fear there is just another additional cost kind of getting pushed down to, you know, people who are hedging in that world because of the capital requirements increasing for banks. And while they may not be originating as much as they used to, a lot of those banks are providers of liquidity, you know, either through warehouse or through, you know, TBA trading out there. So I think folks were interested about that. And then the other last one, and this one personally impacted me recently, so it was nice to hear about this, is there is starting to gain some momentum for relief on title insurance for refinances. Both Fannie and Freddie are looking into ways to help there. And then also we've seen it where there might be some policy impacts there as well to help. You know, I did a refi in February or March, right when rates ticked down, and I still had to pay X thousands of dollars in title insurance, even though I bought the house 9 months prior. So that, if you want to talk about cost to the borrower, they're going to notice that more than a couple hundred bucks on a credit pool. So there is still wood to chop there. I think the right people and the right things are either in the room or being talked about for the industry, but there's still work to be done to help. And then a lot of conversations about LL comp and what folks can do there. But that's obviously a very hairy issue.
Yeah, touchy subject. I mean, money doesn't come from nowhere. Lowering LL comp for refis, for instance, is something we've talked about on the podcast. Maybe the same reason that title insurance should be a little bit cheaper on a refi. There's less that goes into that transaction. And maybe the borrower has done a loan within the last couple of years and it doesn't make sense to charge them the same amount each time you roll that loan forward to give them cash or to lower that rate.
Yeah, I think at least the time requirement would be great. Like, okay, I get it if you haven't, you know, done a transaction in 6 or 7 years, but if you're, you know, refiing within, you know, 3 years of your initial loan or something like that, like what's changed, right? Like, is there a reason to have to repull title? The joke I make is that there's no one like on a horse riding over the mountain with the D-tier house that's going to like try and like get you out of it. So I don't know.
No, it's an institution though, and it just needs some adjustment. So, and it all adds up to the borrower, like you said. A few thousand bucks is a few thousand bucks. That's a ton of money over time that can balance out a slightly higher payment. Yeah, the credit thing is interesting. We talk about it a lot here. We're going to have the VantageScore folks on here, I believe, next month. And Basel III, we're also actually coincidentally going to have a podcast about that. We'll have some experts on to talk about what that's really going to mean for the industry, because I think there's two sides to it. There's MSR, there's liquidity, there's also investment in an MBS, which has an impact on mortgage spreads, as we know, spread between Treasury and MBS. So we'll have a couple guests on to talk through that. That's great stuff, man. That's a pretty compact conference. How long was the conference? Like how many days?
2 days. And it was the good thing about this was it was you had like the afternoon without any like scheduled like content. So you had like a jam-packed morning where they had all these great speakers and, you know, scheduled from like 7 to 12. But then there was time in the afternoon to either network with your colleagues or, you know, one day I did more networking. The other day I did in my room just catching up on what was going on in the world and a couple calls that I had. But that flexibility was super nice. It allowed you to kind of breathe a little bit and like have some, you know, work on your thoughts and work on like what, you know, different things you wanted to talk about or network. So it was a really well done event for sure.
Yeah, that's great. That midwinter conference was very similar. I mean, it was at Beaver Creek. So, you know, people wanted to do a little bit of skiing, even though we didn't have the best season out here in Colorado this year. I believe in previous years, there was, you know, very dense sessions in the morning. And then people got a chance to go out and ski together. That's a networking opportunity, but also a chance to clear your head, because 2 straight days, like morning to night of sessions, I believe is can be too much, right? Too much to absorb much of it or get much value out of it. Great, man. Well, that sounds like a great event. Really appreciate you representing us there, of course, but also coming back with some really good information to share with our viewers and maybe some inspiration for folks to look into sending their execs to that event next year.
Hope I get the invite next year.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks again, man. And that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.